Good afternoon. Are council ready? Please proceed.
May it please the court, good afternoon. This court is set this time for the appeal of Newcastle Shopping, LLC versus Penmark Supermarkets, Inc., doing business as Thriftway. I'm Herbert Mondrose, appearing on behalf of the appellant. Your Honors, in this case, the trial court awarded the appellee nearly $300,000 in attorney's fees and costs, notwithstanding the documented and proven fact that Thriftway pursued a false case before the Court of Chancery with an improper motive, seeking relief it was not entitled to for injuries that it did not suffer. Thriftway did this by providing false testimony and suborning false expert testimony and attempting to conceal the true source of its injuries from the court, from the defendants, and even its own experts and lawyers. But for the accidental discovery of the Fleming objection, Thriftway would have perpetuated a fraud on the Court of Chancery. The fraud was thwarted, and Thriftway, in the end, achieved the slimmest of relief. It sought more than $1 million in damages and obtained one nominal dollar. It sought broad injunctive relief against the sale by NWL of more than 1,700 items and obtained what even the Chancery Court termed an injunction against the intermittent and minimal sale of three items. Newcastle Shopping LLC appeals from the trial court's fee award. Under the extraordinary court facts of this case, ask this court to vacate that award.
Let me interrupt you here. The trial court made a determination based upon the party's contract, didn't it?
That is correct, Justice Ferber.
So we're not talking about the normal, if you will, question about whether fees should be awarded based upon the court's discretion or the conduct of the parties. We're talking about a contractual provision which in its own way is no different than a contractual provision that says you give me these goods, I pay you this amount of dollars. So I'm not sure I'm following the argument about opposing parties' conduct as it applies to a contract issue.
Justice Burrow, we cite three common law doctrines which we argue imparts the trial court with discretion to interpret the contract.
Mr. Bondi, excuse me, could you move the microphone closer? Your voice is dropping.
Thank you. First is the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, which, as this court has held on numerous occasions, is inherent in every contract in Delaware. Second is the unclean hands doctrine, and third is we cite cases relevant to the bad faith exception to the American rule on attorney's fees. Now, it could be argued, and I think where Your Honor is going, is that the latter two, unclean hands doctrine and the bad faith exception to the American rule, might have a more limited application where a contractual provision is at issue. And our view is that the unclean hands doctrine deals with reprehensible conduct.
Unclean hands doctrine, though, basically is a defense that normally calls for an equity action not to be entertained. Your side never moved to have the action dismissed and all the determinations vacated after it was established that there had been false testimony.
Justice Jacobs, actually, at the end of trial, we did move. We didn't move. We argued in our post-trial briefings that the case should be, no relief should be awarded to the plaintiff on account of the plaintiff's unclean hands. For the purposes of this appeal, our appeal is limited to the trial court's ruling on attorney's fees, and we argue that the reprehensible conduct of the plaintiff, be it unclean hands or be it subsumed within the doctrine of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, should operate to deny an award of fees to the plaintiff. And likewise, we argue that the bad faith exception, which deals with vexatious bad faith conduct, and there are numerous cases in this court, also is subsumed within the analysis of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
Your side never asked the court to award attorney's fees against the other side in your favor, did it?
We did not, Justice Jacobs, and we told the court we were not. We argued that it might be justified, but in an effort to be reasonable, that we felt that this was a case in which each party should shoulder its own attorney's fees.
I mean, the arguments, at least the unclean hands argument and the bad faith argument all normally point toward relief that's irrelevant to what you were actually seeking here. And it's apparent that the reason for that is that you're in a, as Justice Berger suggested, you're in a different doctrinal position. Basically, the issue here is whether the court's award of fees was reasonable within the meaning of the contract provision that permitted an award of attorney's fees. Isn't that correct?
It is correct, Your Honor. Yeah.
And reasonableness is a discretionary matter, at least as far as this court's review is concerned. Is that right?
This case is here. We argue that there are two standards, whether the trial court understood the true breadth of its discretion and also, assuming that it did, that it certainly abused its discretion because the outcome in this case is unacceptable.
So your argument is and has to be that an award of any fee in these circumstances is an abuse of discretion.
And that is our argument. That this case, under the facts of this case, with the conduct that the plaintiff engaged in below, should not be sanctioned or rewarded by the court, but rather should be discouraged.
Well, didn't the Vice Chancellor, in effect, take that conduct into account by the partial award of fees?
The Vice Chancellor awarded partial fees, and what the Vice Chancellor tried to do was to parse out that part of the case that was devoted toward the plaintiff's damages set part of the case versus its injunctive proceedings part of the case. And when I read that certainly was news to me. It was news to my client. Our view throughout was that damage, this was about money. This was about the plaintiff seeking more than $1 million in damages. And I think that the two cases are inextricably intertwined. Your Honors, there was the issue of damages and injunctive relief were inextricably intertwined and certainly couldn't have been parsed out, and it was an abuse of discretion to parse it out in the first place and then to make the calls of, I think it was apportioned $250,000 towards injunctive relief and $26,000 of fees towards the damages case. In addition, I was struck on the way driving down here. There was some mediation in this case, and obviously the rules of the Chancery Court provide that what happens in mediation stays in mediation. But it's unfortunate because I think that also sheds light on how the case was divided up, damages versus injunctive relief.
Did the $26,000 deduction represent the time that had been expended in connection with the damages claim?
Purported to represent that. That's correct.
So if that's correct, then that fully accounted for, that is, that would have compensated your side for any attorney time and litigation time spent in defending the damages case?
I'm sorry, Justice Jacobs. I'm not sure I understand the question. The $26,000 was deducted from the plaintiff's final bill, and that's what the Vice Chancellor determined was attributable to the plaintiff's efforts at proving their damages case.
So they got no fee for the damages portion.
If we accept the Vice Chancellor's characterization, we believe that it was a gross abuse of discretion of Justice Ridgely to apportion the case that way.
When you say if we accept the Vice Chancellor's characterization, what do you mean by that?
Well, exactly that, Justice Jacobs. We believe that the Vice Chancellor abused his discretion, that his finding that damages was a very minor part of the case and injunctive relief was the major part of the case, what took all the parties' time, as he said. We do not believe that that was the product of an orderly or logical reasoning on the part of the trial court.
So the $26,000 did not, that is, the deduction of that number from the total attorney's fees bill did not compensate your side for any harm caused by being required to defend the damages case? Is that your point?
That is certainly our position. Our
All
side
right.
was...
Is there... What in the record supports that argument? You're basically saying, if I understand you correct, that the damages claim permeated the entire case because the... And I'm not putting words in your mouth, but this is what I hear you saying. The facts that underlay damages and the claim for injunctive relief were intertwined. You couldn't segregate them out, and so it cost your client a lot more than $26,000 to defend against the damages claim.
I think that that's correct. The only damage, the only injury that the plaintiff claimed in the trial.
Yeah, that's your argument. I'm asking, my question is, what is the record evidence to support that?
The only claim that the plaintiff made was that it was injured because of lost sales, lost profits, and lost customers. That is the same claim that supported the damages case. The my client wasn't compensated at all for the $26,000.
And you didn't ask to be.
And we didn't ask to be, and I did not.
Isn't the precise issue whether there's a proper allocation of the damages case and the dollar amount towards that and a proper deduction? And if it's not $26,000, then what is it? What was the number? Did you suggest?
We did not suggest a number, Your Honor.
If you didn't suggest a number, then are you going to suggest one to us?
Yes. Yes, I'll suggest one to this honorable court, that fees and costs should be denied to the plaintiff because of the plaintiff's abhorrent, egregious, vexatious conduct below. The plaintiff, the court, I'm sure, I know, has read the briefs and understands the full breadth of what happened below. It was outrageous conduct.
But I think that what the members of the court are trying to find out is your argument is there should have been no fee award. We understand that. Let's assume for a moment that the court feels that the contractual provision for the award of attorney's fees should be honored. And then the question becomes, what is the appropriate amount of attorney's fees in light of the misconduct? And you're saying that the trial court, abused its discretion in the way it allocated the portion that attributed to damages. And what we're trying to find out is, do you have a different number to suggest? And if so, what is that number based upon in terms of what's in the record?
Your Honor, when the trial court entertained the fee petition, the plaintiff put in its numbers and suggested a deduction of $26,000 from its total attorney's fees. And in our view, and maybe it was the incorrect view, that's not where the debate was. This is essentially, as Your Honor points out, a contract case. And if the court examines the contractual provision, Section 21 for attorney's fees, the tenant under the lease was given vast discretion as to how to act, whether to act, how to act, how much to spend acting. And the only constraint on the tenant's discretion is the common law, the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, which we submit requires the tenant to exercise good faith in how it seeks to enforce its terms under the lease. It has to spend reasonably, and we would submit as though it's spending its own money, not spend wildly, because it knows at the end of the day the landlord is going to pick up the tab. So in our view, the debate was not how much is appropriate towards damages and how much is appropriate towards injunctive relief. We thought the debate was whether the plaintiff should be paid at all, given its conduct in what we viewed as blatant breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
So in other words, you were then and you are now taking an all-or-nothing approach, that you're not willing to concede that any allocation should be done, because in your view, if you want to call it an allocation, it should be a 100% allocation toward wrongful conduct and therefore no award. And if that is your position, that's fine. But we're just trying to make sure that we haven't missed some argument in favor of a different number, but still a number and not a zero.
Let me answer this way. The Vice Chancellor asked the same question during the fee hearing. And I think you can look at it temporally. The plaintiff filed its complaint in Chancery Court, I think, on July the 3rd of 2003. It filed its Fleming objection in the Bankruptcy Court on July the 21st, 2003. I think realistically, the court could award fees based upon, it's up to that date, up to the date of the Fleming objection, when it knew it, its damages, it had formed an opinion that its damages were not completely controlled, caused by NWL and the landlord. Alternatively, the plaintiff was compensated to the bankruptcy court by a loan forgiveness of $330,000, which was more than it even sought in damages in this case, in January of 2004. Perhaps that would be a benchmark. At that point, it not only knew that it not only thought that it had been damaged by Fleming as opposed to NWL's food sales, but it actually knew it because it had been compensated for that.
Rebuttal time, which you're welcome to use or save as you wish.
Your Honor, this is not, strictly speaking, a bad faith exception to the American rule case. But that exception deals with vexatious conduct, falsifying evidence, improper discovery practices. And that type of conduct should not be tolerated, whether it happens in a fee-shifting case under the American rule or whether it happens where the parties have a contract. And that's where we argue that the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing comes in. As a matter of public policy, the court has seen the briefs. We argue that the Chancery Court, by ordering defendants to pay $300,000 in attorney's fees and costs, actually gave the stamp of approval of the kind of conduct that went on in this case. And this court and the courts of Delaware work long and hard to set high standards, and those standards have to be enforced. And with there is slippage over time. Each of your honors has been in trial courts before, and we ask that this court exercise its exclusive supervisory authority to prevent what happened in this case from becoming the new standard in Delaware, that it's okay to testify falsely, hide evidence from your experts, causing them to testify falsely, hide it from your lawyers so that they can go out and prosecute a case that you know to be false. That sort of behavior should not be awarded. It should be punished. And I will save the remainder for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. Amy Evans from Cross and Simon on behalf of the appellee. The appellee in this case is Penn-Mart Supermarket. The appellee in this case is Penn-Mart Supermarkets, Inc., which trades as Thriftway, as Mr. Mondros indicated. The owners are Mr. and Mrs. Grisillo, and they are pretty much in the store daily handling operations. Because the appellant appeals an award of fees and costs, the standard of review is an abuse of discretion, and a review of the trial court's ruling shows that the judge's decision is not arbitrary or capricious. Vice Chancellor Noble determined that the appellee was entitled to an award of fees and costs. Was entitled to an award of fees and costs based on the contract. And as the court is aware, the American rule is that the party litigants bear their own expenses, but it's well recognized that this can be shifted by contract, and that's what happened here. There was a lease that provided for the appellant to pay the appellee's fees in the event that the appellant breached the lease. The trial court, in awarding fees and costs, carried out the intent of the parties under the contract. In this case, because the appellee had to cure the default of the landlord, then we were entitled to the payment of fees and costs. The appellant would have the court disrespect this provision of the contract because of a prior inconsistent statement by the appellee and because, according to the appellant, the appellee prosecuted a, quote, false case, end quote. Mr. Grisillo made a prior inconsistent statement as to the effect or the impact of the bankruptcy of one of its food suppliers, and that was Fleming. He was impeached by Mr. Mondros, and as a result, the monetary claim for damages failed. The court correctly observed, however, that this inconsistency did not impact Thriftway's claim for injunctive relief. It has to be remembered that it was the appellant
there is the wrongdoer, was the wrongdoer, is the wrongdoer. And the trial court's decision on the merits determined that the appellant breached the covenant, that the National Wholesale Liquidator Store was aware, had constructive notice of this protective covenant, that the New York bankruptcy court order did not interfere with Thriftway's rights, the appellee's rights, under its lease and did not prevent the relief sought by the appellee, that the appellee had been irreparably harmed, and that injunctive relief was appropriate. That order or that decision was not appealed to this court, and that stands. So in his ruling on the fee motion, the court observed that indeed the bulk of everybody's energies in this case went to those issues, in particularly the New York court bankruptcy court order. Significant time and arguments went into the effect and impact of that order.
And that's something on which you prevailed?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. We prevailed on the as to the bulk of the issues that everybody had. Let me try to rephrase that eloquently. The bulk of the energies which the parties had argued and decided, the plaintiff prevailed on those issues.
Well, there was liability, that is, whether there was a breach of the covenant, and you prevailed on that.
Yes.
And your side prevailed on the question of whether there was an entitlement to injunctive relief.
Yes.
But then there was the damages issue.
Yes.
You lost.
Which we failed.
Okay. I understand that the fee application that your side put in was for, close to $400,000?
Roughly, Your Honor. It was it was just a little over $400,000, I believe.
All right. And then your client basically reduced that downward by about $26,000, which you claim was the value of the time spent pursuing the damages question?
Right. In the affidavit submitted in connection with our motion, I prepared a calculation and tried to apportion out what the attorney's fees and costs were in connection with the monetary damage claim. The court also did not award fees in connection with our CPA expert, Mr. Claybrook. So he took that out as well, as in addition to ours. So in addition to $26,000, there was, I believe it was like $14,000 for Mr. Claybrook that was not awarded as well. And in addition, the court reduced the expert fee for Mr. Flickinger by an amount, and the court also reduced the fees or the charges that we had Bridgepoint, and Bridgepoint was the one who had helped us prepare exhibits that gave like a correlation, let us know what NWL was selling, what Thriftway was selling, and those exhibits there. And he did reduce the award in connection with that as well.
Well, your opponent's arguing that this is setting a new standard that we shouldn't allow to be set by the Vice Chancellor because of your client's conduct, that they shouldn't be rewarded for it, and that a new rule has been established. What's your response to that?
I don't believe that a new rule is being established. A couple of points that I will make in regard to that. It seems to me that he's seeking for the equity court to punish, and I don't think the equity court is in the nature of punishing. It's equity. What is fair and reasonable. And I'm not saying that I don't think an award of this is condoning what happened. As the court observed, Chancery Court observed, we lost on the damages because of what happened. And that, the court felt, was significant enough. I think you need to also balance the policy of enforcing the contract. And essentially, that's what this case has been about.
Does that mean that if the other side had asked for attorney's fees for defending the damages claim, that that would have been awardable under the contract?
I don't believe there is a provision in the contract that provided for that scenario. If I understand, could you repeat the question?
Well, if the other side prevailed entirely, would they get attorney's fees under the contract?
No. Right. Not unless, I believe the only provision in the lease would be if we had breached the lease. And then I think there is a provision in there. But under the facts of this case, if we had lost completely and they had totally prevailed, there is no provision that would provide for attorney's fees for the other side,
right,
or the appellant.
However, what we have here, if I understand it correctly, is two competing concerns with respect to attorney's fees. The one, as you've pointed out, is that this is a contractual provision. It gets applied just like any other contractual provision. It happens to apply to attorney's fees, but it's a contract action, so to speak. The other side is saying that this court should not ignore the equity concerns about allowing arguably a wrongdoer to benefit by its wrongdoing, which, even though you have a contract, the opposing counsel is saying that's what's happening here. And I guess what I'm trying to find out about, to follow up on Justice Ridgely's question, is that to the extent that there was misconduct, that arguably could have supported a fee application from the other side that would not be based upon any contractual right to attorney's fees, but would be based upon the equitable principles that govern an award of attorney's fees in cases of egregious abuse of the litigation process.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree that the other side could have, but apparently chose not to, sought to recover on its own behalf for some of its attorney's fees based upon a claim of misconduct?
It could have. The attorney's shifting. It could have sought, if it did, it would have been under the bad faith exception, which I believe. And I hadn't looked into is whether if you need to be a prevailing, no, that probably wouldn't apply. I would say, yes, they could have sought that under the bad faith exception to seek attorney's fees.
They could have filed a cross application.
Exactly.
You know, your side would have had its application for attorney's fees based on the contract. The other side would have said, fine, but the other side, the winning side, owes us fees because of its bad faith conduct in this litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And if both sides are right, there would have been a net award, I suppose, or maybe no award.
Right. The court would have portioned, could have apportioned, or, you know, in its discretion,
it could have awarded fees to both sides, but
exactly.
Your fees, your net fee would be reduced by the side of by the amount of the other side's fee.
Perhaps, yes. Yes, sir.
Well, are you conceding that that claim would have been successful?
No, I am not. As a matter of one case, particularly, I guess, was the Grupo case that was mentioned in connection with the bad faith. In that case, the court separated out what was apportioned to bad faith and what wasn't. So if the plaintiff succeeded on, plaintiff said, all right, yeah, defendant acted in bad faith. The court found they only acted in bad faith with respect to one claim. So it only allowed fees in connection with the claim with which they acted in bad faith. I would have preferred had Mr. Grisillo not made an inconsistent statement. But everybody, or at least as trial attorneys know, there's impeachment in every trial, every witness is. Mr. Mondras at the end there was mentioning about improper discovery practices, and that wasn't even argued or I have no idea what that is in reference to.
What about the comment about the experts being given false information?
Well, the experts, again, like attorneys, Mr. Grisillo did not inform the experts about what he had made to this objection in the Fleming Bankruptcy Court. Our one expert, who is Mr. Flickinger, who is the guru in the food industry, he was knowledgeable, and his expert report did reflect that he took into consideration Fleming's impact, but he had not been aware of Mr. Brasilla's statement. I believe Mr. Flickinger's expert report had indicated that there was transitory, I'm trying to think of the language, like a transitory negative effect as to the Fleming matter. I don't believe, I don't believe it can or has been established or shown that Mr. Grisillo did this in any way as far as fraud. In his mind, being in the business for so long, he saw a drop when NWL came in and figured, you know, that's harming me. And he had a right to believe that because he had a covenant.
Sorry, did he make this inconsistent statement by accident?
I'm not saying accident. I think in his mind, he just didn't think about it.
What does the record show? Did the record show what was in his mind?
Only by his statements.
Right. And it's more than just an inconsistent statement. It was launching an entire damages case based on a fact that he knew was inconsistent with what he was arguing to another court, and which he concealed from his own experts and yet had them testify before the Court of Chancery. I mean, that's a little bit more than just an inconsistent statement, isn't it? It sounds as if you're trying to sugarcoat behavior that's not excusable. If you're trying to do that, I think you may have an uphill battle.
I am not trying to sugarcoat it in any way whatsoever. I'm just trying to indicate that Mr. Grisillo just didn't, in his mind, it just didn't, he just didn't feel it was impacting his sales and customers as he thought. He couldn't remember what that $69,000 was that was post-petition in the affidavit, and he in the testimony, I believe he indicated he felt that it was him having to pay White Rose, who was a supplemental supplier, to bring in food and stuff for the shelves so that there would be product on the shelves. But I'm not in any way trying to sugarcoat what was happening. But
the Vice Chancellor described the proof of the bankruptcy claim as showing unclean hands, that hasn't been cross-appealed, right?
That's correct.
So we have unclean hands, but he also found that the suit was not commenced in bad faith.
That's correct. I think the
so
basis...
help me understand, what's the difference between unclean hands and bad faith for purposes of attorney's fees? Is it this narrow exception where you don't allow fees as opposed to awarding fees? If there had been a cross claim for bad faith?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
All right. Well, as I understand the Vice Chancellor's opinion or ruling, he accounted for the unclean hands in refusing to award attorney's fees to your client. But apparently that's not enough to establish bad faith, which would allow an award of attorney's fees to the other side. Is that right?
Yes. But he didn't need to make that. I think so. I'm not sure I'm understanding. But he didn't need to make that decision because the other side, the appellant, didn't ask for it.
But he did say that action was not filed in bad faith.
And that's correct, because we have injunctive relief I mean, it wasn't filed in bad faith. We had irreparable harm. We received injunctive relief. There's nothing incorrect about that.
The lawsuit wasn't filed in bad faith.
That's correct.
But the damages claim was prosecuted with unclean hands. Isn't that essentially what the Vice Chancellor found?
I don't think he necessarily found that the damages claim was prosecuted with unclean hands or bad faith, because Fleming, we said that Fleming didn't impact, it doesn't mean that NWL also wasn't impacting. I mean, Fleming may have had, as Mr. Grissel indicated to the bankruptcy court, had an impact on it.
The unclean hands finding by the court wasn't made as an idle gesture, was it? It had relevance to your case. That is, your side's case below.
That's correct. And as a result, he denied monetary damages.
And my question was only, didn't he find that the unclean hands, wasn't the unclean hands finding made in relation to your side's prosecution of the damages claim as distinguished from prosecuting the entire lawsuit?
Yes, I believe so. Yes. I see I have a yellow light, so if I'll just quickly sum up. One thing I did want to mention is that the appellant contends that the appellee didn't prevail and was not the prevailing party because it felt that the injunctive relief was meaningless and insignificant. And I fail to see this. The plaintiff had the right and sought to enforce and secure its rights under the lease. And as a result, it gained injunctive relief as to perishable items. Enforcing and securing rights under a contract is not insignificant and cannot be considered insignificant. If the plaintiff had done nothing in this case, it would have lost the protections forever as to perishable items under the protective covenant, and then NWL or any other entity could have come in and had a whole produce section, whole dairy department, whole meat department in direct competition with the plaintiff, or appellee, excuse me.
Thank you. Your time is up.
To be sure, Mr. Grissillo of Thriftway did not make an inconsistent statement about what caused his damages. That's not what this case is about. What Mr. Grissillo did was he concealed from everybody involved, even his own lawyers, what really caused his damages. He told the bankruptcy court, Fleming Foods is my primary food supplier. After NWL opened, they caused me to lose $69,000 in lost sales and lost customers, and he was reimbursed for that. During that same period of time, unbeknownst to the rest of us over in the Chancery Court down the street, Mr. Grissillo was arguing that NWL's food sales, only NWL's food sales, caused his lost sales, caused him to lose profits and customers. This was not a case of making an inconsistent statement, to be sure. And that is, I mean, that's the danger of the slippery slope that we're going down here, is that this now becomes an inconsistent statement. And I ask the court to be wary of that. Did Mr. Your Honor?
You're asking us to decide this question de novo, aren't you? When actually our review power is limited to whether or not there was an abuse of discretion.
Your Honor, yes and yes. This court has the exclusive supervisory authority to oversee the conduct of litigants in the courtroom.
Well, if we're to find an abuse of discretion, isn't the only basis upon which we could do it that as a matter of law, the lower court erred in awarding any fee? I mean, doesn't that have to be our finding?
I think that the court can make that finding based upon the record presented. I also think that the court can send the case back to the Vice Chancellor with specific instructions as to if the court found that the plaintiff affirmatively misrepresentations to the defendant in the court and its experts.
But is there any legal authority upon which we could ground a determination that as a matter of law it was error to award any fee?
Your Honor, I go back to the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
That wasn't my question.
Well, that would be the legal basis for that, other than the court's supervisory authority to govern.
So the answer is there is no case authority that you can point to.
Your Honor, I'm aware of two occasions on which this court found that there was an abuse of discretion under the bad faith exception to the American rule, and that's Montgomery Cellular, which involved discovery abuse, and that's what I was referring to.
That was in not awarding attorney's fees.
That was in the court refused to shift attorney's fees, and also the Dover Historical Commission is the other one. I'm out of time, Your Honor. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for the presentations. We'll take this matter under advisement and stand in recess.